Hi, this is Kip Laxon, and I want to welcome you to this episode of the Faith Matters Today podcast. And we are, of course, deep into the Advent season. This recording is just preceding the fourth Sunday in the season of Advent. And today is part two of my previous podcast episode entitled, Was There a Midwife at the Manger?, in which I'm considering a little-known facts or issues revolving around the nativity story, things that people usually don't talk about much or sometimes don't even know or are not aware of. And so last week was part one, and this is part two. In each of these episodes, I address four issues about the nativity that are interesting, to say the least. And today, the four that I'd like to make a part of this episode, this part two of Was There a Midwife at the Manger, is to consider the angel Gabriel, who is mentioned in the Christmas story in Luke's version of the Christmas story in Luke chapter 1. And then we'll look at the census by the Emperor Augustus. Third, we will consider the manger itself. Now, I'm talking about the furniture, the equipment, the actual manger, what we know and what we don't know about that, that is so much a part of our nativity scenes and our narrations and our dramas and plays about the nativity. And then fourth and finally, we will look at the shepherds themselves, some very interesting information about the shepherds and who they were and who they might or might not have been. And so we begin with the angel Gabriel. In Luke's account of the Christmas story in St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, he makes it very clear that the Annunciation is made by an angel by the name of Gabriel. And oftentimes we read the Christmas story and we see that Gabriel is there without giving much attention to Gabriel. In truth, Gabriel plays a key part in much of the biblical narrative. He is mentioned on several occasions. In the Hebrew Bible, what we also call the Old Testament, Gabriel appears to the prophet Daniel in Daniel chapter 8 and in Daniel chapter 9 to explain the visions that this Old Testament character Daniel is having. He helps him with the interpretation. He's also, Gabriel, mentioned in the book of Enoch, a form of ancient Jewish writings, and is described as the guardian angel of the people of Israel and will defend the people of Israel against the other nations. Gabriel's also translated, the word itself is translated often to mean the strength of God or God's strength. It will vary in some languages how that's translated, but always has to do with the strength of God. I mentioned the Gospel of Luke's account in the Annunciation. Let's talk about that a little bit more in detail. Gabriel appears also in Luke's account to Zechariah and Elizabeth. Elizabeth was a cousin of the Virgin Mary and announces to them that after many years of having no children, Elizabeth now in old age, though we don't know what that exact number is, but beyond typical childbearing years at that day and time, Elizabeth now is pregnant, and she would give birth to John the Baptist, who would, of course, be the forerunner of Jesus of Nazareth. And the angel also foretells the birth of Jesus to the Virgin Mary. Luke chapter 1, verses 11 through 38 covers Gabriel's experience in announcing to Elizabeth and also to Mary. In the wider Christian family, Gabriel is listed as among the saints for the Anglicans, Eastern Orthodox, and the Roman Catholics. It's also interesting that within the Quran, the holy book for Islam, Gabriel is also identified as an archangel that is sent by God to various Islamic prophets, including the prophet Muhammad. In the first five verses of the 96th chapter of the Quran, Muslims believe that Gabriel is the one who comes to announce information to Muhammad. And in addition to that, just for a more wider information about Gabriel, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who we typically call the Mormons, hold that the angel Gabriel and the character Noah refer to the same person, that Noah is his earthly name and Gabriel is his divine name. I could go on. I'll mention just one more. There's an ancient Gnostic manuscript that is titled The Holy Book of the Great Invisible Spirit, where Gabriel is also mentioned and is depicted in that Gnostic literature as a divine being of sorts. Now, within the Christmas story itself, that gives us a feel of the wide references to Gabriel kind of across a continuum. But in the Christmas story itself, Gabriel is sent by God to make this announcement to Mary that she would give birth to the Christ child. You know, we can speculate more, and there's been much of that down through Christian history. But what we take from that, or at least what I take from that, is that this angelic creature, this divine being, if you will, this angel identified as Gabriel, for whatever we want to think about the accuracy or the historical foundation that we may or may not trust in many of these ancient documents, be that as it may, Gabriel was a divine messenger. And God always has a way of, within the stories of Scripture, of getting his message out. Sometimes it's through the prophets. Sometimes it's through other individuals, such as the Apostle Paul and other writers of the New Testament literature and the Old Testament literature as well. And sometimes God does it through these angelic creatures like Gabriel. God's message has a way of getting out. When I think of Gabriel, I think of one created by God for the express purpose of sharing the message of God in a particular context and circumstance. And it calls me to become more aware of God's way of communicating in our day and time. I know it's famously said that you need to treat strangers with compassion because you could be entertaining angels unaware. We really have no record of what, if anything, there is for us to know that happened to Gabriel or where Gabriel is today or what Gabriel is up to now. But a part of the Christmas story is this angelic being who comes to Mary at this unusual time in her life, gives her a sense of comfort and assurance, doesn't offer a lot of explanation from a gynecological point of view or from a biological point of view, but Gabriel does answer Mary's question about how can I be pregnant? I am a virgin. And he tells her in no uncertain terms that the Spirit of God will come upon her and that she will give birth to this child and he will be known as the Son of God. Gabriel is a message bearer. He is telling the story that God had sent him to tell to Mary. So he becomes a part of the Christmas characters. We often leave him out just by mention, but he is as important as so many of the other characters that revolve around the birth of Christ. The second thing that I want to call your attention to that is often left out or at least passed over casually is the census of the Emperor Augustus. And census is C-E-N-S-U-S. It's like a population census when we know here in the United States, they take a census, want to know who's living in the house and how many, what are the ages. That's what we refer to, of course, as a census today. And that's very much like it was in the days of Jesus. Now, why is this important? Well, in Luke's story, again, in St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, the reason why we're given in the story that Joseph and Mary left the town that they were living in, the town of Nazareth, and traveled a great distance to the city or the village of Bethlehem for the purpose of paying taxes and or participating in a census that was ordered by the Emperor Augustus. Now, the contextualization is important, a part of the Christmas story that Luke gives us. Matthew doesn't give us that kind of detail, but Luke takes pains to share that this whole thing happened, Mary and Joseph traveling from Nazareth to Bethlehem, because the Emperor Augustus had ordered this empire-wide census, or at least a census to be conducted in the area of Judea. What we need to keep in mind is, again, the context, that the people of Israel within what we today call the Holy Land were an oppressed people. They lived in a military dictatorship. The Romans controlled the empire, the known world at the time, and they oversaw the land of Israel, and the people living within it were subjects within their empire. For the most part, the Romans allowed the people, like the Jewish people of which Jesus was born, to practice their religion, carry on their life, live out their faith in the way that they chose. The empire was very diverse and very eclectic, with many religions coming to the crossroads of Rome at the time. However, the Romans were very heavy-handed when it came to civic order. They demanded civic order. They tolerated no insurrection. And when that happened, they came down with a heavy military hand and had no qualms about slaughtering those who were insurrection against the empire. They also levied heavy taxes for the purpose of building the majestic structures for the Romans and for the emperor. Tax levels were somewhere around 50 to 60%, and the taxes were not so much about money. People living in the land of Israel at the time had very little money, as we think of commerce today. But farmers would be taxed, giving 50% of their harvest to the Roman authorities. People that farmed and had animals would often have to give a certain percentage of their livestock over to the authorities, to the powers that be. This is the world in which Jesus was born. It was a world filled with fear and hostility, domination, tyranny. But at the same time, there was this census that would often be ordered by the Emperor Augustus. Now, scholars debate as to what the purpose of the census was. Some scholars believe that the Jewish population was expanding, and the Romans were trying to maintain civic control and civic order, and so they wanted to know just what the population of the Jewish people in the land of Palestine was at that time, for the purpose of extricating individuals to serve as slaves in Rome or in various Roman and Gentile villages throughout the empire. That's one reason. That did often happen. We don't know the reason for the order of this census, and there is some question about it. Critics who try to take away the authority, if you will, or the actual foundation of the Christmas story itself, often point that or point out that there is no historical record of a census given or taken at this particular time. And the Romans were very adept at keeping records, and they did of things that they did like a census. There would be a record of that. There is no record of that census. Another criticism that's often levied against the Christmas story, as we have it in the first chapter of St. Luke's Gospel, is that Quirinius is mentioned as being the Syrian governor in charge of Judea. Quirinius would have been assigned or appointed by the Roman emperor or the powers in Rome to oversee as a governor, famously so, as Jesus then becomes an adult male. At the time of his crucifixion, we know that it was Pontius Pilate who was the governor of Judea. At the time of the birth of Jesus, Luke tells us that it was Quirinius, and so he would have been the one responsible to oversee this census at the time of Jesus' birth. One of the questions about that is that Quirinius was not the governor. His rule, according to Roman records and historic records, did not begin until 6 AD. So this was likely after Jesus' birth, but yet Luke mentions him as being the governor at the time of Jesus' birth. So how do we reconcile that? Does it really matter? Well, it can be reconciled, and New Testament scholars and historians have sought to do that. One plausible reason that is often given is that there were common occurrences of various census taking throughout the Emperor Augustus' reign and throughout the time that Quirinius was there. Possible this one wasn't recorded for whatever reason. Or another reason that is often given that I find to be credible is that Quirinius was the governor of Judea on two different occasions. He ruled early on, which would have placed him in that governorship prior to the birth of Jesus and right up into it. And then he was removed and served in another part of the empire, and then came back to Judea as the governor in 6 AD. Now, Luke may have not have known about that, or he may have assumed that because Quirinius had been the governor, he was now the governor. Rome did not always communicate with the Jewish people living in the land of Palestine of who was going to be governor for what period of time, and when one was removed to go to a different part of the empire or to be involved in a war in another part of the world or whatever the case may be, that wasn't always communicated. Rulers and kings and governors often transitioned. Oftentimes they would hand, a Roman ruler would hand off the rule to his son or grandchild, or the emperor in Rome would remove one and install another without consultation or even sharing the news with the people that were living in that particular area. Their subjects did not get the information as quickly. And of course, in that day and time, the information didn't flow as quickly as it does, of course, in our day. There were no emails to be sent out, no announcements, no radios, televisions, social media. And so perhaps Luke simply had known that Quirinius was the governor and assumed that he was the governor at the time of the birth of Christ, because he would be, of course, the governor again in the land of Judea following the birth of Jesus. One thing I find interesting, however you look at this, whether you get into the weeds, as it were, and trying to figure out all of the details, is why Luke included this in his story. Why include that part? Why not simply tell us, by that I mean, why include the names? Why mention the Emperor Augustus? Why mention Quirinius? Why go into that kind of detail? Well, there again, as I've talked about in some previous episodes, one of the reasons that we can trust the historical veracity of the Gospel accounts, at least from my view, is because the Gospel writers do take great pains to name individuals like Augustus and like Quirinius in the telling of their narrative. They're wanting to give it historical verification. If I was writing a history of the governorships of the state of Tennessee or the state of Alabama, or pick whichever state you want to refer to, I would name different ones and when they were in office and who replaced them and what elections they won and what elections they lost. That's what the gospel writers are doing, because they saw themselves as writing a historical account, in this instance, of the birth of Christ. And Luke wants to relate the birth of Christ to a particular historical setting at a particular historical time. He was not writing fantasy, or he was not writing sci-fi. He was not just telling a story, as is often we're told. He was trying to write a credible account of the birth of Christ as he had heard it, as he knew it, and perhaps as has been told to him. One thing, too, that I will point out that New Testament scholars often note is that all the Gospels were not written in the moment, Luke included. They were written after the fact. And when you go back and you write a history of the past in any context, dates can often get confused. Also, some can say, no, that was in 6 AD, while another says, no, I think that was in 5 AD. You get my point. So Luke was dealing with the information that he had at that particular moment and time and when he wrote the Gospel of Luke. Some place the Gospel of Luke some 50 years or even more beyond the actual time of Christ. Who knows for sure? There can be great debate about dating the Gospels themselves. And oftentimes we lose sight of the fact that Luke was writing the story, seeking to verify it in a historical way so that we could trust it, so that we could understand it better, and that we could place it in its proper context. Be that as it may, Joseph and Mary traveled to Bethlehem while she was great with child, as the Authorized Version puts it, which I think is a beautiful way of talking about her being pregnant with the Christ child, for the purpose of participating in this census. Now, the King James Version and some other versions of the Bible translate it as taxes, that he went to pay his taxes. Oftentimes in the taking of a census at the order of the Roman emperor, there would be a tax levied, a travel tax. Joseph had to travel from Nazareth to Bethlehem. And when you gave your information for the census taker would assess a fee that would then be paid at that moment. So one is not right or wrong. It can be translated various ways, but it could also be, excuse me, it could also be the fact that he was indeed paying taxes. He was indeed participating in a census. And he gives us that historical foundation in that moment. Now, let's move on to the beautiful piece of furniture that is so much a part of our nativity stories, of the manger itself. In a few days, I will display a nativity set that we have that is really vintage. And we got it some years ago and love it. It's you've seen these where you plug them in, light them up, these plastic figures of Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus. And we have the wise men and a shepherd and a lamb. And you plug them all in and they light up at night. They come in various forms. This one we have is quite old. That's why I called it vintage. And I'll build a little simple creche, a little simple stable to put in the background. And one of the things we will always do is we have the came with the set itself. It looks like wood, but it's actually plastic. It unfolds in the form of a little manger, a cattle feed trough where you'd place hay in the barn, and that's, of course, where you lay the Christ child. One interesting thing about that, and when my grandson, he will participate with me in that. It's kind of our thing that we do during the Christmas season. And when we put that out, the last one we light up, of course, is the Christ child, and there's Christ, the Christ child in the little wooden manger with the hay and Mary and Joseph at his side, and this is how it's often depicted. But there's been some research done about what that manger would have actually been like. Professor Jeffrey R. Chadwick from the Jerusalem Center for Archaeology and Near Eastern Studies at the Brigham Young University in Jerusalem Center in Israel itself has done quite a bit of interesting research. He has a book entitled Stone Manger, The Untold Story of the First Christmas. And what he recognizes in his study is that at the time of Jesus, the manger itself, the feeding trough, was probably not wooden like we think, but rather would have been stone. The Gospel of Luke, as it records the birth of Jesus, says that she gave birth and they wrapped the baby in bands of cloth or swaddling clothes and placed him in a manger. We assume that there were cattle in this stable or that there were hay and straw, though the Gospel of Luke doesn't mention that. And Professor Chadwick maintains that the reason the Gospel of Luke doesn't mention a stable or a barn with hay and animals and the cattle trough is because it wasn't like that, perhaps. That it was more common in the day, in which Jesus was born for a feeding trough for animals, be they cattle or donkeys or sheep, whatever the case may be, would have been made of limestone. And these limestone feeding troughs or mangers have been found in archaeological digs and discoveries that date back to that time. They stand between 12 and 30 inches high, and they were used for watering animals, and not necessarily in a barn. People in Jesus' day did not build barns or stables ordinarily to house their animals. They would do it in one of two ways. Sometimes they would have a cave, and they would use a cave for stabling, if you will, their livestock. In Bethlehem today, I have seen many of these caves, and they're always a part of a pilgrimage that you might take to the Holy Land, and these are places where shepherds and farmers with livestock would keep their livestock in these caves. These are limestone-like caves, and you can imagine the feeding trough being that form of a limestone that, by the way, in the time of Jesus and in that world, this limestone was more abundant than was trees or wood to be used for the building of a feeding trough or a barn or a stable. And perhaps one of the reasons Luke doesn't mention it is because that wasn't the way it was. And, you know, who knows for sure? But as we look back at that particular time and place and what we now know historically and archaeologically is that it may have been a little different. These were watering troughs, limestone watering troughs that were very plentiful in ancient Israel versus the availability of lumber that would have been used or needed to be used for something like that. And I mentioned there were two ways that they would stable their livestock in a cave. Another way that was very common in those days was the houses that they built would be two-story, the lower level open for animals to be boarded at night or whenever, and above the stable, if you will, or above that area where the livestock were kept would be where they slept or where they lived. This was a very common way that people did it at the time of Jesus. Again, interesting information, though we don't have accurate information or detail. We don't have pictures, that would be nice, or a video of the birth of Christ. No one caught it on their iPhone. That would have been nice if one of the shepherds could have pulled out his smartphone and captured the moment, but we don't have that. What we do have is a simple statement that Mary and Joseph found themselves at the time of the birth of Christ out of pocket, if you will. They were not at home in Nazareth. They were not in a place of safety and security. And so wherever they were, since there was no room in the inn, all of the inns were filled with all of the people who'd come to town for the purpose of this census. They came from north to south, the east and the west. And whenever Joseph and Mary showed up, there was no room for them. So they took refuge in a place where animals normally were, and there was a feed trough. Whether it was wooden or whether it was this limestone, who knows for sure. But in this place, in this unusual location, something they would have not chosen, I'm sure, for themselves, is where they laid the Christ child. That brings me to the fourth thing, and that is about the shepherds. So I found some information that I want to share with you about that that I was not aware of. As I research each and every Advent season, as I'm getting ready to preach in Advent and Christmas, Christmas Day, and then the Christmastide through the Epiphany, the 12 days of Christmas, I'm always looking for something I didn't know, something that I can use or share to refresh the Christmas story in a way that captures us. And as I was getting ready for my series on Advent that I'm preaching now, I ran across some information from a 19th century academic that I was unaware of. This academic's name is Alfred Edersheim. Now, Alfred Edersheim, I was familiar with much of his work on the New Testament documents themselves, but I was not familiar with some work that he had done, as I said, in the 19th century, quite some time ago, on the identity of the shepherds. not their names. We certainly don't have that information, or at least not to date. But it's a possibility that these shepherds were not just randomly out there in the field. Now, I want you to pause a moment and think about this. As a child, and as an adult even, as I imagine the Christmas story, as Luke begins, and there were shepherds out in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were afraid. And the angel said, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." It gives the image, that quotation from St. Luke's Gospel of the Nativity story, it gives the image or the impression that when the angels showed up to announce it, there were just these random shepherds out here in the field near Bethlehem, and the angel chose them almost on the spur of the moment to make this announcement. Now, that may be the case, but there's also this issue that Professor Edersheim points out that I'd like to share with you. He shares that in the Mishnah, M-I-S-H-N-A-H, yeah, the Mishnah is a collection of rabbinical writings and sayings that date somewhere to around 200 A.D. In Jewish lore and history, the Mishnah is additional writings, apocrypha writings, if you will, outside the Jewish scriptures as we have them today that form our Old Testament, our Hebrew Bible. And in the Mishnah, there's information about, at the time of Jesus, who these shepherds would have been, possibly. And what the Mishnah says, that Alfred Edersheim shares, is that these shepherds were not just there feeding their sheep, but they were there for an expressed purpose. He says that these were Levitical shepherds. Now, in and around the city of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, according to the Mishnah, shepherds and their sheep were not allowed to graze or to even live. They were to live outside the city limits, out in the nomadic wilderness, if you will. And that the only shepherds and sheep that were allowed in and around the city of Jerusalem and the city of Bethlehem at that time were those sheep that were being cared for the purposes of sacrificial worship in the temple. Go back in your mind. At the time of Jesus, the temple was a part of Jewish culture. It was at the center of Jewish culture. In the local villages throughout Palestine, you would have a synagogue, which was like a local house of worship. But at the center of the city of Jerusalem itself, and Bethlehem not very far away, was the temple, the holy site. And it was here that at various intervals throughout the year, the Jewish people would come from all throughout the known world for various festivals, like the festival of Passover. And part of their worship, as it had been all the way back to the time of Abraham, was to bring animals for sacrifice. These animals were representatives of the sins of the people. This is kind of a brutal thing for us to imagine in our day and time when we live in an era of animal rights and local and personal pets that we have, that we love and adore, that are part of our family, our extended families. But in Jesus' day, lambs, turtle doves were used in the sacrificial system of worship, and it was a regular occurrence. These lambs had to come from somewhere. And so the Mishnah has a record that in and around Jerusalem and Bethlehem, there were these shepherds that were given the task by the temple hierarchy, the high priest, to care for a group of sheep for the purpose to be used in the sacrificial worship activities at the temple. Average shepherds and their sheep were not welcome. They must be out in the wilderness. Those in and around the city of Jerusalem were these Levitical shepherds. They were called Levitical. Levitical is a term that denotes the temple worship that happened there in the city of Jerusalem. It's interesting to stop and imagine that rather than these random shepherds and their sheep, these were actually Levitical shepherds tending to a flock of sheep that would eventually be used in sacrificial worship in the temple. And here comes this announcement, pointing in a prefiguration of this Christ child that would be born and would eventually, as a man, sacrificed on the cross. We talk of Jesus' death as an atoning sacrifice. Powerful proleptic imagery of the initial announcement from the angels to these Levitical shepherds, if that's indeed who they were, that what was being born now would ultimately be the Lamb who takes away the sins of the world. Now, you could push this too far because we don't have actual historical evidence that says, yes, that's what God was doing. Yes, that's the symbol behind the reason why the angel chose the shepherds to announce the birth of Christ, the Levitical shepherds, without them realizing that the lambs that they were caring for, if that's what they were doing, for the purpose of sacrificial worship in the temple, that this one who is being born now to bring good news of great joy to the world would grow up to become the one who would pay the ultimate sacrifice in the giving of his life on the cross to show us just how much God loved us, that God was willing to go this far in offering his son. It does provide powerful background and beautiful testimony to those immortal words that I think capture the essence of what God was doing in the nativity of Christ more than any other words in the New Testament. John chapter 3 and verse 16 and 17. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him would not perish, but have everlasting life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that through him the world might be saved. Of all the issues that are not talked about very often or even unknown, I didn't know, I wasn't aware that this might even have been a possibility with these shepherds. All the issues that you could talk about that revolve around the nativity story, beyond our common assumptions about it and our Advent readings during this sacred season, this one captures me the most. To imagine that these shepherds were not accidental, that they were there, a part of the Levitical worship in the temple itself, Levitical shepherds, taking care of a flock of sheep that would be used in this sacrificial system of worship, only to receive this angelic announcement about the birth of Christ. And Luke says that they then, when the angels left, said to one another, let's go and see this great thing that has taken place. And they went, and they found Mary and Joseph and the Christ child. Isn't it awesome to imagine? And it is just our imagination, but still yet, isn't it awesome to imagine that these who received this first announcement, caring for these sheep to be sacrificed in the temple, actually witnessed the one who had been born into the world, who would ultimately show us what sacrifice is really all about. Who knows for sure, but it's interesting to contemplate, and it's interesting to imagine that God was doing something that eludes us, that God was up to something in a behind-the-scenes sort of way that actually has a powerful message to it. I want to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and the happiest of New Years. And whether you're traveling or your family and friends are coming to your house, or the presents that you share, or the presents that you give and that you receive in this sacred time, I want to encourage you also to find a place of worship, especially on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. This year is one of those unusual years that only comes around every so often when Christmas Day falls on a Sunday, on the Lord's Day. Here at Muncie Memorial United Methodist Church in Johnson City, Tennessee, where I serve as the senior pastor, we have multiple worship opportunities on Christmas Eve. Check out our website at muncie.org, M-U-N-S-E-Y, www.christmasdayworship.org, and also our 11 a.m. worship service on Christmas Day in the main sanctuary. If you are in the Johnson City area and you're looking for a home church, please know that we'd love to have you. We'd love you to be a part of our extended church family. Or you can watch us online on the live stream worship on Sunday morning as well. You'll find it there at that same website. I'm grateful to Brett Smith and John Redman and Ed Temple for making this podcast happen each and every week. And I want to let you know that with the holidays upon us, and you're busy and I'm busy, I'll be doing quite a bit of traveling in the next couple of weeks, in addition to worship responsibilities and liturgical responsibilities here at Muncie. This will be my final podcast for 2022, but I'll be back with you in January as we begin this brand new year that God has for us, and I'll be joining you each week during this ongoing process, because faith does matter today, and there's much for us to talk about, and we just don't have enough time to get it all in. God bless you. God be with you. Until we meet together again, may God's richest blessings be yours. I'll look forward to talking to you again in the brand new year.